Hi, everybody. Sorry for the delay here tonight. I was experiencing some technical difficulties here. My problem is, of course, as you know, I normally have my class slides and my game screen open side by side, and my game screen just absolutely will not obey. It's not cooperating tonight. It is insisting on only showing up either as a tiny, tiny screen about, you know, tiny window about the size, a little bit smaller than a postcard, or a full screen, which means it would take multiple steps for me to switch back and forth in between them. So I was trying to solve that problem for a while. I've now given up trying to solve that problem. So what I'm going to have to do I'm just going to have to stay out of the game until it's field trip time, and then I'll enter the game at that point. So it'll take me a couple minutes to kind of boot up at that point. So folks in Gladden, don't worry. Narnian won't be there during class, but he'll show up right after class and we'll do our field trip as normal. So, and I'm just going to have to run with only my slides here tonight. So thank you for your patience. That is my explanation here at tonight's frustration. So, okay. Tony, we are finally going to reach the end of this long, no good, very bad day for the Hobbits. My goal is to finish Chapter 10 tonight. Chapter 10, that's what we're doing. We're totally going to finish Chapter 10 tonight. But first, let me do a couple quick announcements. My apologies again for having to miss last week. One of my kids was sick, as you probably saw, and I end up spending time not only taking care of my kid, but also cleaning out my wife's car. If you have kids, you probably know what I'm talking about. If not, you really, really don't want to know. Anyway, so it's all good. Pontine gives me a 40% chance that we'll finish Chapter 10. That's fairly generous, Pontine. I think we're going to make it. But as I say, first, some announcements, because we got some pretty exciting stuff coming up here. The first thing I wanted to remind you about, I've mentioned this before, it happened last year, but I want to bring it up again because it's really exciting, and that is our Signum Academy summer camp programs. You may remember the Hobbit Camp that we ran last year for middle school kids. We're doing more kids' camps this year by popular demand. So we're doing our Hobbit Camp again, but we're also doing our Harry Potter Camp, our Narnia Camp, and Madeline Lengel Camp, Wrinkle in Time Camp. It's going to be great. You can see the dates. They're kind of spread out so that people can do multiple camps. Kids can be involved in multiple camps over the course of the summer. These camps are completely free. They're each one 2-week camps. And how they work is they're designed to be a sort of a hybrid experience. Every day for 2 weeks, Monday through Friday for 2 weeks, we have an online large group session where everybody can be involved. We have a primary lecturer, several of whom are our Signum University master students who have teaching experience at the K-12 level, and we're really excited to go through these books with our batches of campers this summer. So the kids will get a chance to ask questions live and talk about the books in that kind of a big group online environment. But then also we have been preparing these really fun detailed activity packets that people can take, and you can be getting together at public libraries, people's homes with homeschool groups and stuff like that, to have some discussions, do some activities and crafts together, to really kind of imaginatively invest yourself in the world of these stories and to enable kids to really kind of dig into what's going on in these stories. So anyway, yeah, it's really going to be awesome. I mean, so this whole camp experience has been really fun. The way that we have been trying to organize it, that we've been partnering primarily with public libraries. It doesn't have to be just at libraries. Again, if you've got a kid who wants to do it on their own, or you've got, you know, a couple friends who want to do it together, that'd be cool. You know, there's no reason it has to be a library. But we do want to partner with public libraries. It's a great place for kids to be able to get together, you know, kids from a local community to be able to get together and do some of these activities together, have some discussions and do some fun stuff together, even watch the classes together possibly. So if you have a local public library that you think might be interested in hosting these camps, again, there's no charge whatsoever, no charge to the families, no charge to the libraries. It's free for everybody. We just want to encourage kids to be reading awesome books this summer. What I encourage you to do, go into your public library. If you're part of a homeschool group or something, talk to them, right? Go into your public library. If they're interested, you know, tell them about these programs, you know, that they could, sort of host a chapter there at their own library. If they're interested, send us an email and let us know. So on this page, which is, signumuniversity.org/academy. So this is the Signum Academy, which is our K-12 kids programs. You will see all this information about the camp schedules. Click on this link, which is just an email to camp@signumu.org. Send us an email. Give us some contact information. Encourage them to reach out to us, but it's okay if you've talked to them. Just send us an email and say, hey, I live in this town and I talk to our public library and here's their email address and they're interested to hear more. I encourage you to reach out. A lot of the libraries that ended up participating last year, a lot of the kids who ended up involved in our Hobbit program last year, we got connected to through word of mouth by people like you guys who are participating in our programs and stuff. So spread the word, because this is awesome. This is free and it's going to be great fun. And I'm really excited about being able to expand our program this year, to do the Hobbit again, but to expand beyond the Hobbit, go into some other awesome kids book experiences. So that's the plan, right? So I want you to spread the word about that. Two other things that I wanted to remind you about. First of all, Mythmoot. Mythmoot is coming, right? We have registration open through the end of the month of May, so we're getting down to it now. Only about a week and a half left to sign up for Mythmoot. We've got almost 100 people coming. We've got John Garth. We've got Douglas Anderson, author of The Annotated Hobbit. We've got Mark Ockren, the guy who wrote the book on, who invented the Klingon language, coming and give us some Klingon language lessons. We also have, and this is brand new, we're going to have a live talk from Tom Shippey. So Tom Shippey can't come physically, but we have convinced him to log in and give us a live lecture at Mythmoot. So those who are attending at Mythmoot will be able to interact with Tom live in this special talk that he's giving on the theme of Vikings. As you may have heard, his new Viking book is coming out very soon. If you want to hear him give a lecture on those topics as well, not to mention, as you say, the Mad Violinist, the hosts of the Prancing Pony podcast are going to be there at Mythmoot this year, and we're going to record a live episode together, and it's going to be great. It's going to be fantastic. And Tony, yes, we will post the video of the Shippey talk later on. That will be available. We're not trying to, you know, withhold everything from people who can't come to Mythmoot. But again, if you want to be part of that live and be able to ask Tom questions and interact with him, you got to be there. Mythmoot. Now, even more awesome than before. We're running out of time. So through the end of May, you can register. So please do see if you can come to that. The last thing, Baymoot. Our Northern California regional gathering in the San Francisco Bay. It's located in Oakland, California, August 18th. 2018. So that's our next regional event that's coming up. The reason I wanted to mention that specifically, I've mentioned it before, and we've got a bunch of signups for that already, so that's looking really good. But I also wanted to bring to your attention that their call for papers goes through basically through the beginning of MythMoot. So you've got about a month. Anyone who has any ideas or proposals, or you know, that would like to give a talk, would like to read a thing, would like to lead a discussion, participate in a panel, would like to hear a particular panel or something, you know, to suggest an idea or whatever, go ahead and make that suggestion. So again, just click on the BayMoot link here, and you'll be able to. There should be a link for the call for papers, and here's the email address here. Email to baymoot@signumu.org to talk about possibilities for talks and presentations there. So anyway, that's going to be great. So I'm looking forward to meeting a bunch of people at BayMoot as well. Okay. And those are the announcements for today. Now, I see people teasing me. No, we haven't gotten through chapter 11 yet. All right. So tonight, danger closes in. Having gotten pretty much through the whole "who is Aragorn" question, right? Aragorn has revealed himself, and now we're in a, most of us anyway, Sam's still a little skeptical, but the rest of us are in a relatively comfortable place as far as Aragorn / Strider is concerned. Aragorn, when he speaks of himself in the first person, Strider, when he speaks of himself in the third person. But of course, we still have one more event of the chapter, and that is, of course, the realization of Merry's disappearance and then his reappearance, and, of course, the word about the danger closing in around them. So that's what we're going to be looking at tonight. One question I wanted to get to from the discussion board, because it was a really good one, before we officially go back to the text there. This from Jonathan Castles. He says, we said we were looking out for Shakespeare references, especially references from the Scottish play. I missed the last couple of weeks live, but I was catching up on episode 59 today and realized no one pointed out the link between Frodo's line, "I think one of his spies would well seem fairer and feel fouler, if you understand," and the witches, "fair as foul and foul as fair" line, in, of course, Act 1, Scene 1 of Macbeth. Certainly, very true. Right. Okay. So, and let's, or if you did, yeah, Mad Violinist did comment on that. At least I missed it. If you did comment on it, we didn't talk about it. So let's talk about this for a second. Seems to be an echo there, right? Now, obviously what Frodo is saying is not the same thing. But that juxtaposition of fair and foul, I agree. It's hard to get away from the Macbeth echo. It's a very famous phrase from Macbeth, right? So, you know, Jonathan wasn't sure what to do with it, right? You know, he said right after that, you know, he's not really sure what to make of that connection. So let's think about that for a second. So Frodo is talking about the gap between appearance and reality as far as the stranger is concerned, right? That a spy of Mordor might appear fair but be foul underneath, whereas Strider is foul on the surface but feels fair underneath, right? Has this disreputable, rascally appearance, and yet Frodo has this sense that that's not the reality, that he's putting up a false bad front rather than a bad guy putting up a false good front. This brings me back to the conversation that we had earlier on about what seemed to be almost like an elf friend recognition thing, right? Like there's something about him that, you know, Frodo gives kind of Frodo a good feeling about him. And we were talking about wondering if maybe that was the both of them being elf friends, for instance. There seems to be something that people can kind of perceive. But let's think about this in conjunction with that line in the play, because again, I certainly agree. This would appear to be an echo, even if that's, you know, Tolkien isn't thinking about Macbeth here. It's hard to avoid Macbeth when he uses that particular phrasing. Is it possible that Tolkien used that phrasing just because of the alliteration? And we know how Tolkien feels about alliteration. Quite possibly. But again, we know, if there is one play of all of the Shakespearean canon, if there is one play that we know for sure that Tolkien, you know, was thinking about very consciously, and was kind of in his mind and influencing him at various points, it's Macbeth. It's, you know, the one that he has, you know, explicitly alluded to, in several places. So Veronica, yeah, exactly. The whole the prophecy and Eowyn's fulfillment of the prophecy being not identical to, obviously, but kind of reminiscent of the unexpected fulfillment of the no man born of woman shall slay Macbeth prophecy. Absolutely. In order to do this fairly, let's go back to the text, right? Let's actually make this comparison here. Fortunately, Act 1, Scene 1 of Macbeth is so short, we can put it all on one slide. So here is the entirety of Act 1, Scene 1 of Macbeth. Let's look at this. We get the three witches meeting on a blasted heath with thunder and lightning going on overhead, right? When shall we three meet again, in thunder, lightning, or in rain? When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won, that will be ere set of sun. Where the place? Upon the heath, there to meet with Macbeth. I come, Grey Malkin, Paddock calls, anon. Fair is foul, and foul is fair, hover through the fog and filthy air. So we have our witches, right? And they're talking about when they're next going to meet again, which is, of course, the next time they're going to meet again is when they meet Macbeth and deliver their prophecies to Macbeth, which sort of ensnare him right into his downward spiral. When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won, so they're gonna meet him after the battle, of course, as you doubtless remember, as I am sure that every single one of you retains crystal clear memories of the play Macbeth. Macbeth, of course, is the triumphant general, of the armies of Scotland. They've just won their battle, right? Well, at least that is the faithful people of Scotland have won this battle against the Thane of Cawdor, who has shown himself a traitor. He's been rebelling, right, against the king. And Macbeth is, as I say, the winning general, the heroic general, and the triumphant general and heroic warrior as well, who wins the battle. Now, notice that the business at the end, I come, Grey Malkin, Paddock calls anon. That's them talking to their demonic familiars, essentially, right? So, what this is, what we're getting there, you know, the reason we're talking to our demonic familiars there, this is kind of a reminder for those of you who remember not only Macbeth really clearly, but your late 16th century English history. Witchcraft was kind of a thing at the end of the 16th century. It was H-O-T hot in the culture of late... James I of England, right, King James, who succeeded Elizabeth I, was all over the witch thing, right? He wrote a book on demonology and witchcraft. He was like... It was like his hobby, witches and demonology. So this was... And, of course, he's also from Scotland, James. It was, of course, James IV of Scotland. So... Anyway, this is a very topical play in these ways, and he's here, Shakespeare, is here invoking the widely accepted and certainly authoritatively described connection between witches and demons. That's how witches, of course, do their thing and get their power, is by their demonic familiar spirits. And so we see here Shakespeare kind of evoking the sort of traditional knowledge about witchcraft, right, that is circulating in his culture at that time, right? So he's clearly setting, these are the bad guys, right? These are demonic, these are wicked women, right, who have sold their souls to demonic familiars and who have been given powers. We see them, you know, doing these black rituals and things later on in the play. Very, very bad. Okay. And then at the end of this, so having explained that they're preparing to meet Macbeth, right? They have plans for Macbeth. They then end the what's their plan? What are they going to do? Right? We're only given two clues about this. One is they're chatting with their demonic familiars, like it's not going to be anything good, right? But secondly, of course, is the couplet that we get that they say in unison at the end, fair is foul and foul is fair, hover through the fog and filthy air. So what does that mean exactly? Fair is foul and foul is fair. What is the significance of that line? This is, of course, what we've been building up to, right? What does that line mean in Macbeth so that we can think about it and compare and contrast what it means here to the usage that that Tolkien has with that pairing, with the fair and foul pairing there in chapter 10. So here, what is the emphasis? What are they say? Why are they saying fair is foul and foul is fair? And I would say that there are two things that I would say. Right here, we're talking about reversals, right? We're not talking about something seeming fair and actually being foul, right? That's not the issue here. Here, we're talking about fair being foul and foul being fair, right? Either, you know, maybe in perception, in a sense, but also... in reality, right? This is a kind of prediction, in a sense, right? On the one hand, they're kind of setting the theme of what they're going to be doing, but they're also kind of making a prediction. Macbeth, of course, he's going to be our tragic hero. He's going to make some very bad choices over the course of the play, right? Which is going to lead him into this sort of moral death spiral that's going to, you know, lead him down until he almost completely vacates his humanity by the end of the play. I mean, he's barely even human at the end of the play. But we have to remember that at the beginning of the play, he's not just like an okay guy. He's an awesome guy. He's a hero, right? He's not just a supporter of Duncan. He's like the guy who just save Duncan's biscuits, right? I mean, he is the most loyal, the most faithful, the most admirable general. He is as fair gets, right? So fair that Duncan is going to reward him with the thaneship of Cawdor, right? With the title and lands of the treacherous dude who was just captured and overthrown by Macbeth's virtue and prowess, right? On the one hand, fair is foul, foresees, right, how Macbeth is going to fall from being, you know, at the pinnacle of things that he is here at the opening of Act One, to the remarkable depths to which he is going, to the depths of foulness to which he is going to sink at the end. So on the one hand, they are kind of both predicting and kind of reveling in the this identity, right? This mixing and the kind of fluidity, right, between fairness and foulness that they're going to help bring about, and that they're looking forward to bringing about. So on the one hand, the fairness and foulness, this is about, it describes a shift within him. But it's also, in a sense, about perception, though, again, not in the same way as in the Fellowship of the Ring. Again, it's not about foul things like mistaking a thing that which is truly foul for something that's fair because its appearance is fair. It's kind of deeper than that, in a sense, not deeper, but different anyway. He is going to be, when they greet him, right, with their prophetic and tempting greetings, right, with their prophecies that he shall be king hereafter, they're inviting him to look up to fair things, right? He's just been, he is the Thane of Glamis, and that's a noble position. He is about to be awarded the Thaneship of Cawdor, right? And that's an excellent and enormous reward, and he's going to be king hereafter. Isn't that lovely, right? That's, so just the three things that they say when they greet him, is it's each one is more fair than the one before, right? These are brilliant predictions, right? Brilliant prospects that they're opening up in front of him. But of course, as his eyes are directed towards these quite in themselves very fair things, right? We see that he immediately begins looking down at foul means, right? Having achieved the Thaneship of Condor through his excellent actions, now we see him immediately contemplating murdering his king, you know, this act of murder and treason, this very, very foul means by which he is going to achieve that fair thing. And so now we have this muddy line, right, where this fair thing, this fair prospect that's been put before him is foul. It's not about seeming, right? It is. It's fair, but it's also foul. And this is the way, this is the state, right, that the witches are going to create, that the witches are going to put things. Not to mention, it also kind of changes things, right? Again, Thaneship of Cawdor, that's like, wow, right? He's going to have two Thaneships? That's amazing, right? What a wonderful reward. Who wouldn't be happy and satisfied with that, right? Well, somebody who's just been told that he's going to be king and maybe should start looking into that, right? So the Thaneship of Cawdor, which seems like, again, an enormously fair and attractive thing, now looks, you know, mean. It's, you know, that which was fair is now foul. He's totally unsatisfied by that now with this other thing. And this action, which is completely contrary to everything he's ever done and anything he's ever been, right? That is the murder and the treasonous murder of the king whose throne he has just been defending so valiantly. That's incredibly foul, that action, right? And it begins to look more and more attractive to him as a means to this end. So in the play, what we're getting here in this first scene, what the witches are doing is playing with means and ends, right, to confuse fairness and foulness, right? So again, it's not about appearance and reality, a gap between appearance and reality. It's about what is really foul and what is fair. And that which you considered foul before, well, now looked at from this different perspective, seems like something desirable as a means to an end, right? It might be a foul means, but, you know, you can get over it, right? Because it's there's goodness there at the end, right? There's a reward at the end. So this is the significance, I would say, anyway, would be my explanation of the significance of this line in the play, fair is foul and foul is fair. So when Frodo, going back then for a second to Jonathan's quotation from the scene we looked at last time, I think one of the enemy's spies would seem fairer and feel fouler, if you understand. Notice that although, again, these same terms are being used, exactly what Frodo is not suggesting is any confusion between those things, right? Or any confusion would be one merely of deception, right? There's no question that foulness and fairness are actually being confounded here. And there's no questions of means and ends or anything like that. This is merely, how can you judge appearances? Even that conviction that Frodo has, right, that he acknowledges that spies of the enemy, that, you know, the servants of evil can look fair, right, but that even if they did, they would feel foul. And what he's describing here, right, that whole sentence is a setup for the observation that he's trying to make about Strider, right? He's saying there's something that doesn't fit here, right? There is a disjunction between how you seem and how you feel, right? What I am perceiving in of your essence and what I am, you know, seeing on the surface of your appearance. Those two things aren't fitting for me. But the way that they don't fit is not the way that I would expect them not to fit. You know, so that kind of disjunction, totally normal, right? Totally normal. Just what I would expect, except the opposite. I would expect a servant of the enemy, a lying, deceiving spy of the enemy, especially, right? Orcs don't look foul and look fair and feel foul, right? They just look foul and feel foul, right? But a lying, insinuating spy of the enemy may feel foul, but there would be a disjunction, Right. They might look fair, but they would feel foul. So again, the key, and I agree exactly, Tony, that the important words in that sentence are feel, and seem, absolutely. That's what he's talking about, right? So his use, I won't say that his use of the words fair and foul are, incidental. Like I wouldn't go anything like as far as that, but I agree that they're not the crucial terms, right? Whereas again, in the line in Macbeth, those terms are almost the entire line, right? Fair is foul and foul is fair. The only other thing we get are linking verbs, right? In that line, linking verbs, which just identify the two things, right? Taking the concept of fairness and foulness, mushing them together, switching them around, because it doesn't matter, right? It's a linking verb. It's commutative, right? So to use the flip a math term into the grammatical observation. So this actual confounding of fairness and foulness is what the witches are all about. Whereas Frodo's observation is based on an assertion of his ability to perceive difference, right? This disjunction might be different, but it would still be there, right? Fair is fair and foul is foul would seem to be the premise upon which Frodo's statement is made, right? Yeah, now that's a good question, Fourth Dauntless. He asks, does the word seem have an express connection to sight? Not necessarily. No, I don't think it's just about, I don't think it's just about sight there. But it's well worth for a second thinking a little bit more about those words. Seem and feel in those instances. What's the difference between seeming and feeling? As Frodo is describing it here. I don't think that seem is only a sight word, though I'd say in the way that Frodo is using it, it would seem to be primarily about sight. But I guess the way that I would say it is seeming is about the superficial appearance to the senses, right? Which will be mostly sight, as you know, but it would also be hearing, right? I mean, heck, it could even be smell, right? Whereas, yeah, Tony, feeling would be more like a personal experience. It would be just something that you perceive on a deeper level. Again, that kind of like almost spiritual resonance between elf friends or, Marianne says, seeming implies illusion, feeling implies a deeper perception. Yeah, deeper. I keep going, getting back to that too. I'm not totally satisfied with that way of describing it. But yeah, Marianne, I think you're thinking the same thing that I am there. Good. Mad Violinist points out that when Aragorn paraphrases, right, when he picks up on it and says, meaning I look foul and feel fair, right, he uses look instead of seem. So Fourth Dauntless, that's really interesting, right? That's kind of how Aragorn translates it, that connection between seem and look. So I don't think that we can just identify it. Again, it's not only about sight, but it would be primarily about sight. In any case, like that which, you know, a merely external view by the senses would reveal, right? Compared to this sort of deeper kind of, I don't know, intuition, JJ? Yeah, sort of, I would say even sort of spiritual perception, essentially. Anyway, well, I'm glad we settled that. Hey, look, you know, I'm not apologizing for a long Shakespearean aside because totally worth it, right? We got to do a fun analysis of the first scene of Macbeth, so there we go. Tony, yes, it's just like when Gandalf talks about what his heart tells him. Yeah, there's this kind of intuition, this kind of deeper, this feeling thing that Frodo is describing, or rather this thing that Frodo is using the word feels to describe, right, is clearly a is clearly a legitimate phenomenon in the Tolkien world, right? And I would encourage us to sort of watch for other examples of that and to be thinking about this kind of remembering back to this scene to see if we can get some other examples, maybe build some other vocabulary from within the text sort of what this is, what this means, what this is about, what, you know, how we can describe this thing. So anyway, okay. Yeah, Tony Elrond is big on this. So is Aragorn, right? He does this kind of thing all the time. Yeah, good. Erukheb says, Tolkien liked the idea so much he made an elvish phrase for it. Gurin bed eni, my heart tells me. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Ambrosius Aureliana says, we should really read Macbeth in the original Quenya. It really works better. It works better there. Yes. Yeah. That might be, by the way, the subtle allusion you are making. Is, I think, my favorite line in all of Star Trek, right? when they talk about reading Shakespeare in the original Klingon, that is absolutely, I think that might be my favorite single line in all of Star Trek. Anyway, okay. All right. Hey, chapter 10. There it is. Okay. So, now that we have established Aragorn's identity, we're going to begin our conversation with him. When did you last see Gandalf? Asked Frodo. Do you know where he is or what he is doing? Strider looked grave. I do not know, he said. I came west with him in the spring. I have often kept watch on the borders of the Shire in the last few years when he was busy elsewhere. He seldom left it unguarded. We last met on the 1st of May at Sarn Ford down the Brandywine. He told me that his business with you had gone well, and that you would be starting for Rivendell in the last week of September. As I knew he was at your side, I went away on a journey of my own, and that has proved ill, for plainly some news reached him, and I was not at hand to help. I am troubled, for the first time since I have known him. We should have had messages, even if he could not come himself. When I returned, many days ago, I heard the ill news. The tidings had gone far and wide that Gandalf was missing and the horsemen had been seen. It was the elven folk of Gildor that told me this, and later they told me that you had left your home, but there was no news of your leaving Buckland. I have been watching the East Road anxiously. Do you think the Black Riders have anything to do with it? With Gandalf's absence, I mean? Asked Frodo. I do not know of anything else that could have hindered him, except the enemy himself, said Strider. But do not give up hope. Gandalf is greater than you Shire folk know. As a rule, you can only see his jokes in toys. But this business of ours will be his greatest task. Okay. Hang on. Tony's trying to distract me from this slide. Yes. Okay. So Tony says, quick question about the paragraph just before this. I wonder if the, with Sam's permission, when he says, so with Sam's permission, we'll call that settled. Is Aragorn gently mocking Sam for his, with your leave, Mr. Frodo, from earlier in the conversation, right? When he says, with your leave, Mr. Frodo, I would say no. Right. And so him now turning to ask Sam's permission. Yeah, Tony, I like that a lot. Actually, I hadn't really noticed that echo, but you're right, it is an almost direct echo of Sam's own words. Yeah, I like that a lot. Okay, so Gandalf, notice what, so in a lot of this confirms conversations we've already been having, right, when we've been talking about his movements. When Gandalf met Radagast, we haven't heard about that yet, right? But when he received the news from Saruman and the invitation to go to Isengard, he believed that Frodo was going to leave in the last week of September, right? So that Frodo's departure was, remember, this is midsummer that he's getting this news. And it was before that. It was on the 1st of May that he met with Aragorn. So he's in the Shire. Right, Gandalf's in the Shire meeting with Frodo back in April, right? They do chapter two. They do the Shadows of the Past. He makes his plans, right? He decides he's going to leave. We infenestrate Sam, right? All this is happening in April. And then soon afterwards, Gandalf says, you know, I feel a little anxious. I'm not sure why. I'm going to go and find out. What does he do? He goes and finds Aragorn, right? That, so we have every reason to believe that Gandalf went more or less straight to look for Aragorn from Bag End, right? When he leaves at the beginning of, chapter three. So he meets Aragorn, tells Aragorn, you know, that his business went well. That is, the whole conversation ending with the infenestration of Sam went well, right? He, Frodo, is planning to leave with the ring. So all of the information that Strider has about Frodo and the ring and Sam and all that stuff, that it dates from this May 1st conversation with Gandalf. Right. So as far as Aragorn, and then he had to go. So he's a busy guy, right? He had stuff to do. Gandalf seems to have everything under control here. Remember, Gandalf was coming to check and see if there was bad news. He had this sense that something bad was going on. So who does he ask? Strider, right? Who else would know better than Strider, who is not only himself going about at a great rate in this area, but also is, of course, going to be in touch with the other rangers around here, right? So fine. So he goes and talks to Aragorn. What does he find, right? Everything's fine, right? Aragorn hasn't heard anything. So there's, Aragorn obviously has no bad news to tell him. So Gandalf comes and says, I'm kind of anxious. What's up? And Aragorn's like, nothing, pretty quiet, right? Everything's fine. And Gandalf's like, okay, so Frodo's going to leave in a few months. It's May 1st. He's going to leave in September, right? So we're talking 4 months from now, almost 5 months from now, Frodo's going to be leaving for Rivendell. And Gandalf's there. So when Aragorn leaves, no reason to suspect that anything's wrong. No reason to suspect that Gandalf's going to leave. Why would he leave, right? He's not going to leave, right? So he leaves Aragorn, right? Then comes back and finds Gandalf is gone, and the Black Riders are in the area, and Frodo has still not set out, right? So this is not... in one sense, a big deal. Like, that is, he doesn't know about the letter, right? He doesn't know that Frodo was supposed to have set out in July, right? So he doesn't know that Frodo's late. Frodo's still on schedule, but it's just all of a sudden, holy cow, the Nazgul are here, and where's Gandalf? He had everything under control around here, right? And now all of a sudden, nothing is under control. Everything is going, and nobody knows where Gandalf is. And that Gandalf would be detained. Notice he's immediately talking about Gandalf being like that, you know, that he's Gandalf is missing and the horsemen had been seen. Gandalf, it's not just that Gandalf is gone, right? He's missing. He's supposed to be there and isn't. What could have hindered him? Something must have hindered him, right? And Frodo asks about the Black Riders, right? Do you think the Black Riders had anything to do with it? Did the Black Riders capture Gandalf? Did they kill Gandalf? The answer, probably, right? Notice Strider has two conversations with Gildor. Gildor is obviously part of Aragorn's network in this area. Right. Gildor and his people are traveling through here and they're keeping Aragorn informed. Right. So he's had two meetings, or he has heard tidings from Gildor. It was the elven folk of Gildor told me this, told him what? That Gandalf was missing and the horsemen had been seen. Right. So Gildor knew that the Black Riders were in the area before he, Gildor, met Frodo, right? He already knew about the Black Riders. Remember back to the first interactions that they have when Pippin busts out with tell us about the Black Riders, right? And the elves are like, Black Riders? Why do you ask about Black Riders? They're not saying this because they've never heard of them. they're saying this because they don't know why the Shire hobbits are asking about them, right? They've heard about them, and they know that they're in the area. Obviously, they've heard of the Nazgul, but they've heard that the Black Riders are in the area, right? So when you think about it, the elves' question, right, the Black Riders, why do you ask about Black Riders, sounds completely different now, right? Originally, it sounded like, hey, well, that's kind of out of the blue. Like, what are these Black Riders of which you speak? We might have been tempted to interpret their questions that way, right? Now it is clear that the emphasis is quite different, right? Wait a second. Why are you asking about Black Riders? Do you know something about Black Riders? How do you know anything about Black Riders? They were totally unaware that there was a Black Rider like 5 yards away from them, right? So they, you know, it ran away as they approached and they didn't even know it was there. They're disturbed to learn that it's there in the Shire already, right? That, I mean, Gildor knows at that point, right? He knows that Frodo was just this close from being captured by one of the Nazgul, right? Which, of course, is why he's like, why don't you come along with us for tonight, right? Yeah, exactly, Tony. They're not surprised that they're abroad. They're surprised that they're in the Shire. That's exactly it. Yeah. Now, Mad Violinist asks, are we meant to think that by missing, Gildor didn't mean that he was specifically expected, but simply that they expected Gandalf to be where the Nazgul are? Possibly. I have got to think that Gandalf probably talked to Gildor too. But I have to think that they knew at least that he was in the area, right? That Gandalf was kind of the one in charge of this whole Shire business, right? So the fact that he's not around again, that he's not been heard from in some time, would probably strike them as odd even, yeah, I mean, so I think they know he's supposed to be around. Why did the elves not mention that Gandalf went to see Saruman? They don't know. That's the significance. Gandalf finds that out from Radagast, as we'll learn later. He is near Bree when he finds this out, goes, stays that one night of the Prancing Pony, and then heads south. He does not interact with Gildor and the elves. He doesn't interact with any of the Dúnedain. The only person with whom he interacts between Radagast and Saruman is Butterbur, right? Let's see. So Gildor is learning something when he learns that Frodo expected Gandalf and that Gandalf failed to make the meeting. Yeah, he's learning details that he didn't know. He knew that Gandalf was missing. Gildor seems to be then even more concerned when he learns that there was a definite, like, appointment that he was supposed to come by this date at the latest, and he hasn't come, right? So for Gildor, this seems to move it from general unease, like, okay, hang on, wasn't Gandalf supposed to be around? Like, where's Gandalf? I have not heard from Gandalf in a while. The Nazgul are here and Gandalf is missing. Did something horrible happen, right? This kind of a vague sort of anxiety about Gandalf to, okay, now we have concrete reason to know, like, he would not fail to keep his, to keep his tryst, to keep his appointment with Frodo. He would not fail to keep that unless this proves that something serious is amiss here. So, okay. I don't know of anything else that could have hindered him except the enemy himself, says Strider. And this is fun in a couple ways, right? First, that he can't think of anything, right? Notice how unthinkable to Aragorn the concept of Saruman being a traitor is, right? That Saruman would have turned on Gandalf and held him prisoner, that's completely off the radar, right? I mean, no one suspects that. So that's one interesting thing to observe from Aragorn's words here. The other thing, of course, is that this is really fun for, and those of you will know what I'm talking about right away who have been doing the History of the Lord of the Rings series with me in the Mythgard Academy on Wednesday nights. Of course, you'll remember from the return of the our discussion of the Return of the Shadow that Gandalf, of course, in the original drafts, when these, you know, words were first written, Gandalf had been captured by the Nazgul, in fact, and was being held in a tower to which he had fled, and in which the Nazgul had trapped him, basically. So Gandalf had run up a tower, and they couldn't take him, because he was defending himself in the tower. So he was trapped more than exactly held prisoner. He was, like, besieged, essentially, by the, and the Nazgul were surrounding him. Treed is a good way of describing it, Tolonial, actually. Yeah, exactly. Tony was just thinking the same word. Yeah, they had treed him, essentially. But yeah, they were the ones, in fact, who were holding him prisoner. So, exactly, JJ. Saruman's treachery is an anti-Eucatastrophe. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, good, right, but don't give up hope on Gandalf, right? Because he is greater than you Shire folk know. Notice, by the way, I think that both of them here are not wanting to say that they think Gandalf's dead. I mean, that Gandalf was captured by the Nazgul is, like, theoretically possible, but not hugely likely, right? I mean, more likely, they just would have killed him. If they caught him, if they caught up with him in the wild and had a conflict with him, right, and took him down, I mean, that would be a hindrance, right? I don't think that Aragorn is implying that he thinks they've captured him. And that's why I think he says, but do not give up hope, right? Do not give up hope means, I believe, there might be hope that he's still alive, right? Not there might be hope that he might get free from his imprisonment. No one's even talked about that. And I think that Frodo doesn't want to say it, and neither does Aragorn. With Gandalf's absence, his absence, right? He doesn't want to say, is Gandalf dead? But I think that's what they're both thinking and what they're both afraid of. Okay, hang on, move that. All right. Pippin yawned. I'm sorry, he said, but I am dead tired. In spite of all the danger and worry, I must go to bed or sleep where I sit. Where is that silly fellow, Merry? It would be the last straw if we had to go out in the dark to look for him. At that moment, they heard a door slam. Then feet came running along the passage. Merry came in with a rush, followed by Nob. He shut the door hastily and leaned against it. He was out of breath. They stared at him in alarm for a moment before he gasped, I've seen them, Frodo! I've seen them! Black Riders! Black Riders? Cried Frodo. Where? Here, in the village. I stayed indoors for an hour. Then, as you did not come back, I went out for a stroll. I had come back again and was standing just outside the light of the lamp looking at the stars. Suddenly I shivered and felt that something horrible was creeping near. There was a sort of deeper shade among the shadows across the road, just beyond the edge of the lamplight. It slid away at once into the dark without a sound. There was no horse. Okay. What do we get? First of all, we got to keep in mind here, where does Merry have his confrontation with the Black Rider? Right? He does not have his confrontation with the Black Rider in some back alley of Bree, right, where he has wandered around on his ill-judged nocturnal stroll through this strange new city that he is visiting, right? It is right outside the pony that he has this confrontation with the rider, right? I had come back again. So he went out for a stroll, and he had come back again. He was at the pony, and he was standing just outside the light of the lamp. That means, presumably, the lamp that's right above the front door, right? So there's a lamp by the door of the inn, and he was just outside the light of that lamp when all of a sudden this happened. And what happened? I shivered and felt that something horrible was creeping near. He just has this feeling that something foul is nearby, right? As it were. And he sees some deeper shade among the shadows just beyond the edge of the lamplight. It slid away into the dark without a sound. There was no horse. There was no horse is kind of interesting, right? Because, like, it's not exactly a black rider. It's like a black, I don't even know what, right? What is it doing? Black, what, sneaker? Slinker? I don't know what it is, but it's not a black slitherer, possibly. Now, keep in mind, this is the first time Mary's ever seen a black rider, right? He might have seen the one from a distance, right? The one that was on the ferry landing after they had already, they were already halfway across the river. That's the only time that he has ever seen one, right? He was, remember, he said when they told him the story about how they'd been chased by black riders across the Shire, that he would have thought they were making it all up, right? Had it not been for the shadow that he saw on the landing and that queer sound in Farmer Maggot's voice, right? The fact that Farmer Maggot was so scared. Lincoln says that Mary's description of his encounter with the Nazgul in this sequence, and especially the sense of something horrible, was always one of the creepiest parts of the story for me as a kid. Yeah, Lincoln, it is really creepy, right? And this is enormously important to understand about the Nazgul, right? What is so threatening about the Nazgul? It's not that they're going to beat you up, right? It's not even that they're going to kill you. It's the effect that they have on you, right? That is what the Nazgul are about. Yes, they're uncanny. They are scary. They are terrifying. And that's what they do. That's what they did to Mary. What was the Black Rider doing? Scouting? Maybe? I don't know. He's not walking openly around the town. He's hanging around outside the lamplight, right? But he is right outside the inn. Valori says, in her head, there was no horse. Sounds almost accusatory. Like, you said they had horses, right? You said they were riders. I didn't see a rider. You know, I didn't see a horse here. Are they meeting with Bill Ferney? That seems quite likely. Let's get the other half of the story. Which way did it go? Asked Strider suddenly and sharply. Mary started, noticing the stranger for the first time. Go on, said Frodo. This is a friend of Gandalf's. I will explain later. Let's think of this from Mary's point of view, right? He comes in and he's like, I've seen them! Dark strangers! Out in the... they were really scary! And then, like, all of a sudden, you know, this man, that you know, this big person whom he's never seen before and who deliberately looks all shabby and rascally and intimidating says, which way did it go? And he's like, wah! Who are you? So Frodo's like, Frodo's saying this is a friend of Gandalf's is interesting, right? He's told Aragorn that it would have saved time if Aragorn had told him that he was a friend of Gandalf's, right? So he is giving Merry the same shortcut that he says would have made things easier for him, right? And Merry, to do him justice, rolls with this pretty well. It seemed to make off up the road eastward, continued Mary. I tried to follow. Of course, it vanished almost at once, but I went round the corner and on as far as the last house on the road. Mary looked at Strider with wonder. Strider looked at Mary with wonder. You have a stout heart, he said, but it was foolish. I don't know, said Mary. Neither brave nor silly, I think. I could hardly help myself. I seemed to be drawn somehow. Anyway, I went, and suddenly I heard voices by the hedge. One was muttering, and the other was whispering, or hissing. I couldn't hear a word that was said. Then I felt terrified, and I turned back, and was just going to bolt home, when something came behind me, and I fell over. Okay, so what did Mary do? Mary sees a black rider off in the darkness, and follows it. Right? He trails it. He pursues the Black Rider in the dark in the strange city. So yeah, Strider is kind of surprised. Like, you met a black rider in the dark. And not only did you not run away, right? You actually chased it, right? That's really amazing, right? And he is impressed. He is looking at Mary with wonder. You have a stout heart. Very few people would respond in those circumstances to a Nazgul that way. But it was foolish, right? And yes, isn't it fun thinking about Mary's ultimate destiny here, right? Yes, Mary is going to kind of make a little career for himself of being willing to go towards black riders instead of away from them, right? When he should be scared and intimidated. That is really fun to think about. Now he says that it was neither brave nor silly, right? Which is, of course, what he's just said. It was brave, but silly, right? You have a stout heart, but it was foolish. And he's like, I don't know that it's either one. He could hardly help himself, he says. He seemed to be drawn. I don't know how we're supposed to understand that exactly. This kind of compulsion doesn't seem to be, I don't know. So this is to me a really interesting data point, because we're gonna have some interesting moments of the will of a Nazgul having some impact on the will of somebody else, right? Nazgul asserting their will and trying to dominate the will of somebody else from outside, right? But that's mostly going to be on Frodo, on the ring bearer. And it's therefore kind of, so that's kind of a complicated situation, right? Like, it's how much is it the Nazgul? How much is it the ring? Right. You know, it's a three body problem, right? Not a two body problem. When you're talking about the Nazgul's will exerting itself upon Frodo with Mary, it's a different situation, right? He has no reason to be drawn, any other external reason to be drawn other than, I guess, the will of the Nazgul. Belanxmond says, is it the sense of adventure inspired by Bilbo that draws Mary? Possibly. Yeah, it could just be overwhelming curiosity. It could be. But I don't think if it is, then Mary's not being honest with himself about that. What he's describing is not merely curiosity, right? When he says, I could hardly help myself, I seem to be drawn somehow. I could hardly help myself. If he had just said that, if he said, I could hardly help myself, that might sound like he was like, oh, man, I was so curious. Like, there was no way I could possibly not follow under that kind of circumstances, right? I'm sorry, right? No way. But he doesn't just say that. He adds, I seemed to be drawn somehow. Anyway, I went, right? I seemed to be drawn somehow says that he perceived, believed, felt that some external force was acting on him, right? So I don't think this is just his own curiosity, nor do I think that this is really just his sense of adventure or anything like that. That doesn't seem to me to be adequate. Those would be ways in which we might describe him doing something. So, we might say that Mary's spirit of adventure influenced him in his decision to recommend, support the idea of going through the Old Forest, right? That Mary was kind of keen to go through the Old Forest because of his curiosity, if the Old Forest was really like all the stories that he'd heard about it, and his sense of adventure, right? So again, if we said that about Mary, I would think that that would be a perfectly fair thing to say about Mary. But it's not what he's describing here. Maybe he's lying, right? Maybe he's lying to himself. Maybe he's making an excuse here. That's possible that he's making an excuse here. That it really was just his own curiosity. It really was just his own sort of troublesome sense of adventure, right? That's leading him to do this rash and foolish thing. And after the fact, he's like, okay, so that if I just say that, it sounds really dumb. So I'm going to try to diffuse the foolishness of this by claiming I had no choice. I was drawn by some mysterious force that I can't explain. That's conceivable. I can't absolutely rule that out. But I don't think so. Let me say it this way. If Mary's making that up, if that's a cover story that Mary's using to make an excuse for his own foolishness, it's an awfully conspicuous one, because what he's describing is exactly like the effect we are going to see the Nazgul have on Frodo on several occasions. This is a thing that the Nazgul do. This is an effect that the Nazgul have. However, is the Nazgul even aware of him? I don't think so. Is the Nazgul drawing him? I can't imagine that it is. If it is, why isn't it waiting for him around the corner? I mean, it's not that I can't imagine the Nazgul wanting to capture Mary, right? Sure, probably it would, right? And perhaps it would even do so by trying to draw him out of the light and, you know, down a dark street where it could then, you know, pounce on him and drag him off or whatever it is that it was going to do, right? But it doesn't do that. It goes about its business. Mary follows it almost all the way out of town. Did you notice? Where does it follow? Where does he follow him to? Where does he follow him to? We know this. Almost the last house outside of town, heading east, Bill Ferney's house, right? We know that this is Bill Ferney's house. We're going to see when we pass Bill Ferney's house on the way, that same way out of town, the next day, we'll see this explicitly, right? The Nazgul is going to Bill Ferney. In other words, it's not doing anything with Mary. Mary is following it and overhearing it. Mary is effectively shadowing the shadow here. And it does not yet seem to be aware of Mary's existence. Again, if it were, surely it would have ambushed him already. Not just like gone along its, I'm about to say its merry way, gone along its way to meet up with Bill Ferney and chat with him over the hedge, right? While the Hobbit listened on. If it were with its conscious will drawing Mary into, endangering himself in the dark street on his own, it had pounced right away. So, therefore, since I don't believe that Mary is just was merely curious and acting foolishly and is making an excuse for himself, I don't believe that. And I don't see that there's any reason to believe that the Nazgul was consciously trying to draw Mary after it. Therefore, I can only conclude that Mary follows the Nazgul, that this sort of drawing after it is like an unconscious effect that the Nazgul seems to have on what? People, right? And that's interesting. Yeah, Veronica points out it has an effect on geese and dogs too. Yes, though that, I think, Veronica, the dogs howling and the geese yammering, that's their perception that something horrible is nearby, right? that same feeling that Mary got when he's standing there, you know, looking up at the stars outside the Prancing Pony, that sense of something horrible nearby. If he were a goose or a dog, he'd have been screaming at that point, right? That, I think, is what the geese and dogs are responding to. The geese and dogs don't follow him, right? We don't see them be followed along by a crowd of geese and dogs. So I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of this, but I think it's an interesting point for us to kind of watch and see, especially as the Nazgul are, you know, we see the Nazgul interacting with others. This attraction that the Nazgul would seem to have. We have seen it before too, right? Even just in Frodo's temptations to put on the ring and stuff, right? That was ring temptation, but this desire to leap out and reveal himself to the Nazgul seems to me to be not the same, because again, you got the ring involved, right? So there's this whole other factor there, but because it's clearly a ring temptation as well, and yet the sort of premise of that temptation seems to be something intrinsic to the Nazgul, right? This is why I find this passage so interesting, because without this passage, I might have thought that that other stuff was just like 100% the ring, right? But now I'm not sure I do think that it's 100% the ring. Erokeb, yes, the ringwraiths would have a power of domination stemming from their own rings, I would think. That wouldn't surprise me a bit. What's interesting is that it seems to be like an area, like an AoE effect, right? It's like an area, it affects the whole area, right? There's this aura of dominion about them, right? That makes those who are near them just want to follow them, come after them, right? And that's interesting. That's interesting to me. That to me, it puts another little interesting factor into those moments when Frodo is being tempted by the ring and how he's being tempted by the ring. Irinda says, I thought one of the reasons the ring temptation is so powerful around the Nazgul is that they call to it as it does to them. Exactly, Irindis. Yes. And that's why I think this is so interesting, right? That it helps me. I think it helps me. Maybe it just confuses me, but I think it helps me to understand better what's going on with those ring temptations. It isn't that the Nazgul are like communing with the ring and being like, okay, ring of power, do your stuff, right? Frodo is feeling a temptation that is derived directly from the Nazgul himself. And the ring is the one who seems to be taking advantage of that temptation, right? In order to further tempt him to use the ring, right, to reveal himself or to whatever. Exactly. The Nazgul may have some ability to call to others through their will, not simply due to the one ring. Exactly. Because, of course, that other idea, which is hard to kind of avoid, right, the idea that the Nazgul are kind of like almost like working actively in cahoots with the ring doesn't make any sense. Cause if they need to know it's there, right? He would never, like, the Black Rider on the road would never like just turn around and go away. Right. If he knew the ring was right there and had been, you know, and Frodo is experiencing that temptation. So, Yeah, and Fourth Dauntless says this gives us a good clue about how the rings work. The Nazgul are great among men who obtain power from having many followers. The Nine allow their wielders to draw followers to them. That's interesting. Of course, Mary, literally a follower in this case, right? Yeah, perhaps so. Perhaps that's part, you know, that kind of power is part of the power that the Nine Rings give, that seeing things that seems to me and very plausible, really. Yeah. And absolutely, Mad Violinist, I'm not at all disagreeing with the fact that the Ring of Power makes Frodo more vulnerable to this spell, this, you know, this effect that the Nazgul have. Absolutely. Or rather, I guess the way that I would say it is it adds an extra temptation, right? This feeling of like, I really should go after them. I really should reveal myself to them. I really just opens the door for the ring, right? The ring is just looking for an excuse to say like, hey, yeah, why don't you put me on? That would be a great idea. Go off on your own and wear me, right? This seems to be one of the things that, you know, those like the main things that the ring keeps trying to tempt Frodo to do. So when he's trying to hide himself and the ring from the Nazgul, and he's feeling this temptation, which derives from the Nazgul to reveal himself to the Nazgul and to go to the Nazgul, then if he's being drawn towards it, then the ring's going to seize right on that, right? Yeah, hey, go towards it. That's just the thing, right? Why don't you put me on and off we go. Aruran says, which is just another reason for just how concerning the appearance of the Black Riders in Eriador is. It's literally the enemy's ring-wielding core commanders who have left the Gondorian Osgiliath front in search of Frodo. Yeah, exactly. This is, these are the people who crushed the Gondorian armies pretty much by themselves, right? I mean, they had help, but they were the reason why, you know, Boromir was not able to hold them back, why they were able to regain the river crossings. And yeah, here they are. Okay. All right. More. I found him, sir, put in Nob. Mr. Butterbur sent me out with a lantern. I went down to Westgate and then back up towards Southgate. Just nigh Bill Fernie's house, I thought I could see something in the road. I couldn't swear to it, but it looked to me as if two men was stooping over something, lifting it. I gave a shout, but when I got up to the spot there was no signs of them, and only Mr. Brandybuck lying by the roadside. He seemed to be asleep. I thought I had fallen into deep water, he says to me, when I shook him. Very queer he was, and as soon as I had roused him, he got up and ran back here like a hare. I'm afraid that's true, said Mary, though I don't know what I had said. I had an ugly dream, which I can't remember. I went to pieces. I don't know what came over me. I do, said Strider, the black breath. The riders must have left their horses outside and passed back through the south gate in secret. They will know all the news now, for they have visited Bill Fernie, and probably that southerner was a spy as well. Something may happen in the night before we leave Bree. Okay. Eric has a proposition that Nob is the real hero of the Lord of the Rings, as powerful as a company of elves driving off a ringwraith. Yes. Okay. So. Good. Wheel Rider and Mad Violinist were both recalling Mary was having the dream of water, the water nightmare, the flooding nightmare in Tom Bombadil's house, right? Okay. First, who was picking him up? Mary. When Nob rescued him, from whom does Nob rescue him? From whom does Nob rescue Mary? Yes, Fourth Dauntless and Mad Violinist, absolutely. Fernie and the Southerner. I feel fairly confident in that, right? It's two men who are bending over him. I do not believe that one of them is the Black Rider. Now, So what does this mean? Does this mean that the Nazgul, what, left randomly, right? No. This is him, the Black Rider, capturing Mary, right? This is not to say Bill, like, he's not captured by the Nazgul. He's captured by Bill Ferney instead, right? No, that is him being captured by the Black Rider, right? This is how they're operating. What are they doing, right? They're taking Mary, presumably, into Bill Ferney's house, right? What are they going to do there? Question him. Certainly, they're going to question him, right?
Yeah, JJ says the Black Rider's a king. He's unlikely to do his own heavy lifting.
Yeah, and not only that, he's also a wraith. And not really likely to pick up the body of a hobbit and haul it around. So, yeah, Tony, exactly. The Nazgul don't generally interact physically with their enemies. Do we ever see them doing that? We haven't yet, right? We haven't yet. We'll get to the stabbing. The stabbing is interesting, right? And the one time in which arguably this happens, but even that's not simple, right? Because Frodo's wearing the ring when he is stabbed. So we'll get some interactions later on, right? And things are going to change. And Fourth Thomas, hang on, the Battle of Pelennor Field, because the Nazgul are different then. The Nazgul are going to get an upgrade. And I don't just mean Tolkien's going to amp them up in his descriptions. Tolkien was pretty clear in his sort of ancillary writings about the fact that the Nazgul, they get upgraded before the Battle of Pelennor Field. So can the Nazgul pick up Mary and haul him off the street? I don't even know. But to me, that's not even the really important question. The important thing is that's not how they operate, right? The Nazgul did what he wanted to do. He drew Mary after him, which he didn't even know he did, right? But he sees that he has drawn this hobbit after him, and he has overwhelmed Mary, right? Look at Mary. So let's go at Mary's description again. I felt terrified, and I turned back, and I was just going to bolt home when something came behind me, and I fell over. So the Black Rider caught him. He's spying on the Black Rider. He's followed the Black Rider. The Black Rider's talking to Bill Ferney over the hedge. Mary is sneaking up. He's not close enough to hear what they say. He suddenly gets scared, and he turns to run away, but the Black Rider is right there. Something comes up behind him. The Black Rider comes up behind him, and boom, he drops, right? That's the Black Rider taking Mary captive, right? That what he just did to Mary. This is our prototype now, right? We have seen the Black Riders interact with a victim, right? Tony says, I'm sorry, I can't let the Nazgul Dementor connection go. It's okay, Tony. Neither could J.K. Rowling. It's not your fault. Yes. Yes. Erikheb says, so Lotro is completely justified in having the Nazgul always incapacitate us then leave us completely alone to beat up their minions in-game. Yes, exactly. That's exactly how it happens in Tolkien too. Yeah. Okay, so so the Nazgul has overcome Mary. And what we have, again, this is the first time we have seen a Black Rider attack anybody, right? We've seen them interact with people, right? We've seen them have conversations with Farmer Maggot and with Gaffer Gamgee, but we haven't seen them, like, attack anybody. We have now. It just attacked Mary,
right? And it knocked him out. He was overwhelmed by, like, fear, right? And he fell into an evil dream. I thought I had fallen into deep water, he said, right? I had an ugly dream. I went to pieces. I don't know what came over me, right? So his whole spirit, mind was overwhelmed by the rider, right? And he has this sort of visionary experience, right? That is his, you know, he had this kind of dreaming experience of falling into deep water. That's what happens based on this scene, right? This is the one piece of data we have so far in the book to say, this is what happens. This is what a Nazgul getting you looks like. Okay. And so then what? Then, sorry, I just saw Lincoln's comment. No, Mr. Brandybuck, I expect you to die. Yes. So I don't know that he leaves, right? So Fort Thalos is afraid that he's leaving him, Mary, in this easily escapable death trap, and then assuming everything went just fine. Yeah, no, it's not exactly like that. Yeah, right. Like, and I see your response to Fort Thalos there. Yeah, no, not necessarily. Nob. Let's go back to Nob, right? Nob, our heroic figure, right? Coming pelting down the street. Why does Nob save the day? How is Nob able to save the day, right? I think two things. First, it's Bill Ferney and the Southerner who are picking Mary up and about to take him, again, presumably into Bill Ferney's house. Right? Why do they put him down and run away? Witnesses are kind of, this looks bad, right? I mean, it is bad and it also looks bad, right? This both looks foul and feels foul, right? When you see the two guys in the street, and if there were to be a witness to them taking a strange hobbit into Bill Ferney's house, like that would be bad, right? So, they run before they can be identified. Notice that Nob doesn't identify. He can't identify them. He can't say that it was Bill Ferney. We can be pretty. He observes that this was just nigh Bill Ferney's house, that this all happened, right? But he can't prove anything, and that's why they run away. So, and that seems to me perfectly sensible, right? I mean, if... it is dark, remember, so, you know, he can't tell for sure who the people were. Molly says, yeah, they would be placed into that incredibly big Breetown jail. Yeah, sorry, it's another Lotro reference in game. Bree has an enormous prison. Erokeb, I think he does suspect it. I think he is implying that he believes it was Bill Ferney. But he's not saying more than he says. He's being actually kind of being a good witness here, right? He's not claiming anything more than he actually saw. So Nob rescues Mary because they don't want to have any witnesses. They don't want to be identified. There would be some questions asked in the morning. If a hobbit went missing from the Prancing Pony and a witness saw Bill Ferney bringing the comatose hobbit inside his own house, right? That's the kind of thing which even in a small town like Bree, like you're not going to be able to get away with that kind of thing. So it makes perfect sense that they would leave. But what about the Black Rider? Why doesn't the Black Rider do anything? I think there's a fairly sensible answer to this question. Erokeb says, if later events that night hadn't happened, Ferney might still have faced serious questions from Butterbur in the morning. I agree. Katriana, that's a really good point. Katriana says, maybe they recognized Nob's voice and especially didn't want to get caught by one of Butterbur's people. Yet we've seen the kind of influence Butterbur has in the town, right? Butterbur isn't necessarily the magistrate, but if Nob, Butterbur's servant, is able to bring testimony, and I mean, Butterbur, this would be bad, right? Yeah. Yes, Simon says, if I ever lived in a small town, you can't get away with anything without it stirring up talk. People had already talked about Bill Ferney. Yep. No, very true. Very true. Okay. So, but what about the Nazgul? What about the Nazgul? Why doesn't it overwhelm Nob too? Yeah. Irendis, that's my conclusion as well. I don't think, as much as I admire Nob, I don't think the Nazgul runs from Nob. I think that Bill Ferney and the Southerner run from Nob because they don't want, again, they don't want his testimony against him. So they run before, because he's carrying a lantern, right? So they're in the dark. He's carrying a lantern. When they see somebody running down the hill from the pony, carrying a lantern towards them, and he gave a shout, right? Yeah, I gave a shout, but when I got up to the spot, there were no signs of them. Yeah, so shouting and running towards them with a lantern, they scamper. That makes good sense, right? The Nazgul has to not be there. I don't think the Nazgul would be afraid of Nob, and it makes perfect sense. We know that there are several Nazgul in the area. We know that the Witch King is not far away and that he has been sending his riders here and there trying to find some clue for where Baggins is, right? This is a good lead, and he thinks he has secured the Hobbit, and he knocks Merry out, right? And then he says to Bill Ferney and the squint-eyed Southerner, take him into the house and hold him and we'll be back, right? And he goes off to tell his boss, right? That makes sense. No need to supervise the henchmen, Tony. Absolutely. I totally agree. Yeah. Blue Wizard asks if Merry is neither brave nor silly, which is Nob? Brave, no question, right? Nob is brave. Because remember, Nob never sees the Black Rider, right? He's just gone out looking for Merry, and all he sees is Merry comatose in the street, right? He's got to assume, this guy works at a pub, right? He's got to assume that Merry's drunk or something, right? He's got to have seen more than one comatose person in the street before. Anyway, but he sees a comatose hobbit in the street being like about to be hauled off bodily for goodness knows what reason by two very suspicious looking dudes, right? And so he runs towards them with the confidence of his convictions, apparently, because he goes in one on two, right? One hobbit against two big people. Convinced that making a shout and holding a lantern is going to be enough to scare them off, which of course it is, right? Small town. If he continues to shout, he would rouse other people. Veronica, I certainly think that he thinks Mary's about to be robbed. Absolutely. There's all kinds of bad things that could be happening here, right? Tony, I bet he does think that he's stopping a mugging. Absolutely. Absolutely. Sorry, I'm just reading Steve's parody. When Nob there reared his woolly head, he bravely turned his tail and fled. The Nazgul, meaning getting the tail of the Nazgul here running away. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Okay. Right. Especially by Bill Ferney's house. This has got to be the most suspect part of the whole town, right? Absolutely. So therefore I would say, so the Nazgul has acted like a Bond villain, in the sense of, leaving without watching the sort of the final consummation of things here.
That again, this doesn't seem to me very strange given, you know, we know this is obviously not the Witch King himself, right? And he's off to report. And it seems safe, right? Besides which, okay, what's the worst thing that happens, right? Even if Bill Ferney and the Southerner can't manage to maintain their control over one comatose hobbit, right? Even if the comatose hobbit overcomes them and escapes somehow, right? He knows they're in town, right? He knows where they are. He knows where to find them. Okay.
All right. We are pretty good. This is Nob's finest hour, Bruinir. This image of Nob running, shouting down the road with his lantern, right? Rescuing one of the clients of the, one of the patrons of the inn, from mugging or murder, right? Or something. You know, that Nob, he might not be the sharpest tool in the shed, but he's a good guy.
Good. Mad Violinist says Fernie wouldn't have been able to identify him as Mary never came into the common room, which begs the question why they would be ordered to kidnap him. Because he's a hobbit, right? I mean, are you Baggins or have you heard of Baggins? Do you know anything about, I would think, and that's another reason, like, it's not like the Nazgul has left the Ring of Power behind. Right. He's not gone full Bond villain on this. Right. What just happened here from the Nazgul's point of view? What just happened here? Right. There are two things. So there's a strange hobbit. Right. That's a bonus. He's not even going to the Witch King to report the random hobbit they just caught. Right. That's a bonus. He's going to report what he just heard from Bill Ferney, because Bill Ferney just told that Nazgul the story of the man in the moon song, right? He has just heard an account of Frodo's performance in the common room. So vanishing hobbit, right? Spontaneously disappearing hobbit performs at the Prancing Pony. That's the news that he's running off with. What would the Witch King say if he was like, so I heard very definite news that the Ring of Power, the Ring Bearer is probably in the Prancing Pony, but I'm going to wait while I interrogate Joe Random Hobbit over here, because that's just what the Witch King would like. Heck no, right? He's going to say, okay, let's interrogate this hobbit and see if he knows anything about this. You take him into the house and ask him some questions. Meanwhile, I'm going to take the really big news back to the Witch King. So, again, they don't even know who Mary is. They've never seen him before, as you point out. But also, they didn't even, like, he wasn't part of the plan. He's literally just there. Like, why is this hobbit there? Like, all of a sudden, hang on a second, wait. Do you hear something? I hear something, too. It's a random hobbit over here. Oh, you know, like, eavesdropping on us, right? Here, I'll knock him out. Now you take him into the house. Anyway, whatever. I'm going back. So, you know, why do I think they want to interrogate him? Because, well, that's a guess. Maybe they don't. Maybe he's just saying to get rid of him or something. But I would think they would at least wonder or suspect. I could imagine a brief conversation between the Nazgul and Bill Ferney. So Mary keels over. Boom, right? Mary's just hit the dirt. The Nazgul hasn't left yet. I can imagine the Nazgul being like, you know, hey, is this one of the local hobbits? And Bill Ferney being like, I never seen this one before. And so the Nazgul might conclude, maybe this is one of those, because he knows that there are three other hobbits, right? We've got the Ringbearer hobbit and there are three other ones too. Is this Baggins? It's probably not Baggins. Maybe it's Baggins. Probably he searches him for a Ring of Power. I'm guessing.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that the Nazgul would search Merry's body for a ring of power. Not finding the ruling ring on the person of this strange hobbit, he would conclude that he's not Baggins, but maybe he knows something about Baggins. So hang on to him, right? The fact that Bill Ferney and the Southerner are picking him up and carrying him away again, I have to assume, into Bill Ferney's house, suggests that the Nazgul said that that's what they should do, right? Yes, Simon, they do know that there are a party of four hobbits coming out of the Shire. So he knows that the ring bearer has three companions. So the idea, again, Ferney would know that this was a stranger, even though he didn't see him in the common room, he would know that this hobbit is a stranger. So that's why I would assume that was what happened there. But what their plans exactly were for Merry, who knows? And they don't really get a chance. The Nazgul absolutely wouldn't. I mean, I think the Nazgul know pretty well that the Ring of Power is at the Prancing Pony right now. And again, that's really big news. But it's time to report now, right? This Nazgul's got to go back to the Witch King with this news. Because what's he supposed to do? Attack the Prancing Pony, right? Nazgul don't act like that, right? Certainly not here. Certainly not now in Bree. So go back and report while it's night, right? And tell the Witch King what's going on and let's make a plan, right? So all of that makes sense. I don't think the Nazgul is acting weird or that it's like especially convenient that he leaves Merry again. Who the heck is Merry? Might be useful, maybe as in useful information, but it's not. There is literally nothing they could extract from Merry in the way of information that would be more useful than what Bill Ferney just told him, right? Magical invisible hobbit staying at the Prancing Pony. That again, that's the headliner right there. So several people wanting to talk about bed stabbings. We'll get there. Where we're not getting, of course, is quite to the end of this chapter. Though you have to admit, we got further along than it kind of looked like we were going to get for a while there, right? But this was cool. We discovered lots of really fun things that I've never really thought about, here tonight. But it's field trip time. So I'm going to stop here. What do we have? Like three? Yeah, one, two, three. Yep, we got three slides left. So we're totally, not only are we going to finish next time, we're going to finish and start chapter 11 next time. Totally happening. Okay, cool. So thanks for bringing us, say goodbye to the Twitter folks. And, everybody can switch over to Twitch, to the Twitch channel here, twitch.tv/signumu. So thanks Twitter folks for joining me. Say goodbye here somehow. There we go. Okay, no. All right. Good. And Emma Thorne predicts three more classes before the end of the chapter. Ha ha. Okay. Yeah, so we're on Gladden tonight, and give me a minute. I will log myself in. Where am I? Oh, yeah, rebooting my stupid thing. Hang on a minute. Okay. All right.
I don't think you're alone in that. I think we got a lot of AFKs on this one.
Yeah.
Good evening, everyone.
Hey there. Okay. What? Okay. Sorry.
It's being silly again.
Yes. Acting in newfound strange ways. Okay.
I'd quote Brave New World, but that's Tempest, not Macbeth. Yeah. I was so excited when we talk about Macbeth. That was like the one play where I'm like, this Shakespeare dude's actually really fun.
Oh man, I love Macbeth.
Well, I had just moved to England. like that was fun enough. And then my English class starts doing English history and English literature. So that was our first introduction to Shakespeare. And then I think we did probably Romeo and Juliet. It was just, that was a snooze. But
you know,
then then we were told to pick any play we want, read like the abridged Shepherd version, and do a presentation on it.
Okay.
Me and my best friend Andrew Halmo picked Macbeth.
Nice.
I did a 30-minute shadow puppet presentation of Macbeth, just me and Andrew doing all the characters, and I think the playback was Shakespeare Animated Tales, which had just come out that year.
Right.
So I had like the anime 30-minute condensed version with Zoe Wanamaker as Lady Macbeth.
Nice.
Oh, we had so much fun. I loved doing all those witches and those bloody prophecies, and they were so great and so cool and so violent.
No, Macbeth is great. Yeah. It's really, I was really disappointed because my son's ninth grade class this year, they did Romeo and Juliet last year, and this year they were going to do Macbeth, which was great. I'm like, okay, you know, Macbeth is like, it's the perfect tragedy. I mean, I think it's a really wonderful, it's totally if I were, you know, teaching Shakespearean tragedies in high school, like it's absolutely the one I would do.
Yeah. If you want to get freshman boys to pay attention, do the blood and guts.
It's so good.
Do the blood and guts.
It's so good. But it's not even just about that. It's just about, but for Thoughtless, that was the problem. Then she changed it halfway through the year. She was like, nah, we're not doing Macbeth. We're going to do King Lear instead. And I was like, oh man, you've got to be kidding me. Like, don't get me wrong. King Lear is one of the like greatest works of English literature in all of history. One of the greatest works of human art. However, it is way over the head of ninth graders. Like, I mean, the last time I read King Lear, I was like maybe 35, and I'm like, you know, I'm still not old enough for this play. I know I don't really fully get it.
Yeah, 14-year-olds can really relate to the lingering threat of mortality and aging and watching your children get older and defy you.
It's amazing. There's so much in King Lear. It's too much. It is just too much.
Yeah.
I
didn't understand one lick of it when I was a kid.
No. Yeah. I mean, I read it. I don't think I really got it at all like the first four times I read it. And then even after that, I was like, okay, I still only feel that I am like, you know, seeing around the like very fringes of what's going on here. So,
Still don't know why people name their daughter Reagan.
Yeah.
Do not get that.
Yeah. I it's not that I dislike King Lear. It's that I admire the heck out of King Lear. I think it's amazing, but it's just too amazing for high school kids. It is a terrible introduction to like Shakespearean tragedy. I'd go with Macbeth. Not only would I go, I'd go with Othello. Before, I mean, Othello's a little racier, right? You know, you get lots more sex jokes in a much more sexually oriented plot, obviously, Othello. But still, I mean, still way better. Like they're way readier for the kind of stuff that goes on, goes on in Othello than they are for what goes on in Lear.
Definitely. Well, what had just come out in the theaters then was Kenneth Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
That was, as a soppy 12-year-old girl with dreams of romance, that was actually a pretty good one.
Yeah. No, I like a lot of Branagh's Shakespeare adaptations, actually. Not all,
he is Benedict. He is.
That was really good. Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a particularly good one. That's the one with Keanu Reeves, isn't it?
My brother and I do a great impersonation of him. I would rather be a thorn in his side than a rose in his grace. Yeah. Therefore, let me be as I am and seek not to alter me.
Keanu Reeves just not really ready for the Shakespearean stage.
Bless him. Glad he's doing Ted again.
yes. Anyway, okay. So we're going. Where are we going? We're going to Angmar again. And I think like before, we have little choice. So let's go to Estildine. From there, I don't want to slow horse. I want to ride it from there because I want to go a different way.
Okay.
But okay, yeah. So because I want to go tonight, I want to explore pretty much the last part of Angmar that we can go before we cross the statues. So I want to go up the other path where we went at the beginning, near where we went at the beginning. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Yeah.
All right. Mount up.
All right. Here we are. We'll just wait for a few other stragglers in case there are any. But anyway, yeah. So I by like the fiasco of my son not reading Macbeth, I've already had like Macbeth on the brain a little bit.
That's fun.
I had to really restrain myself too, because you know, he was telling me, it's like, oh yeah, so I have an English quiz, and I'm like, oh, what's your quiz on? And she's like, it's on, you know, stuff about tragedy, and I'm like, oh no. Oh no. I'm like, tell me you didn't get taught about tragic flaws. And he's like, yeah, we learned about tragic flaws. And I'm like, oh, do I tell him now about how that's all like a mistake and a mistranslation of Aristotle? Or do I wait till after the class so as not to undermine his teacher?
Wait till he starts writing fiction and then point out tragic flaws, not a character trait.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's not like something, it's not like a congenital defect Macbeth was born with.
And that's what I love about, Aragorn as a character. So many people have tried to ape Aragorn and Strider as a character by making them these sort of lone wolf characters with tragic flaws.
Right.
Now, right. Point of Aragorn has this air of tragedy about him, but we don't spend the entire time thinking about what a tragic figure he is.
Right,
he brings that to the character without hitting us over the head with how maligned he is. And even, yeah,
it's actually a really good point about sort of tragedy in Tolkien, right? Tolkien's great at tragedy, but tragedy is all about
Silmarillion's tragedy at the wazoo. That's the other one.
Yeah, it's all about doom, right? I mean, it's Turin Turambar, right? Obviously, the most tragic figure in all of Tolkien, and you can talk about, like, you know, if you wanted to if you like insisted on doing a tragic flaw analysis of Turin, you could come up with stuff. I mean, that's the thing. That's why.
Oh, sure.
That's why high school English classes do this, because, you know, like it's easily doable. You know, you can make it work. But
well, it's easier to study when it's over the top, too.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, it's easy to oversimplify it and as I say, kind of make it work out. But and you could do, whoa, hang on, my camera angle just went funny. You can that's what happens sometimes when I'm trying to use my trackpad instead of my mouse. Anyway, so wait, where's that? Okay, so I'm looking for the we're going to go through the big old gate, I think. Yeah. So
go this way till it gets all brown and scrubby.
Yeah, make sure we head in the right direction. There, yes, we are. Okay. But anyway, yeah. So the tragedy is really, I think, intriguingly complex. And just to think about Turin for a minute, right? On the one hand, he's doomed. He's cursed, right? Mm-hmm. That's the tragedy of Turin, is that, you know, his fate leads him to destruction. And there's, you know, I love that that passage in the Silmarillion where Turin hears the footfalls of his fate overtaking him, right? Mm-hmm. Which is really great. But at the same time, it's not just, he's also not just like an innocent lamb being, you know, led to the slaughter either. Like he also, his own choices are involved, you know, is his doom something that's brought about by himself, or is it something that is, you know, imposed upon him by the will of Morgoth? And the answer is very clearly both, right? Both of those things.
Well, just like Macbeth, you know, the whole, did the witches set things into events, or would his, you know, would things still have taken their course even if he hadn't known what was going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I do think, looking at not the like typical high school English version of, you know, like the tragic flaws and stuff, but really looking at tragedy, even especially something like Macbeth, I think, you know, you really can see, I think, some ways in which this is all in Shakespeare.
Yeah, it's all in Shakespeare. Right. But that being said, now we go back to our Lord of the Rings characters, that one, the tragedy is more understated, and he's not hitting us over the head with these epic fairy tale characters. Yeah. We're suddenly seeing very realistic people.
Right, right. But, sorry, I'm consulting my map here to make sure I'm going the right way. Okay, sorry. Yes, exactly. So I'm really bad at doing two things at once, so I'm very likely just to like run down the wrong road while having a conversation.
Someone got dismounted. Hang on.
Uh-oh.
We got some...
Yeah, we've got...
low levels here. So.
Right, we have not many people with us, and...
I'm not that good a warden, so...
Okay, all right.
I suspect there are better ways of going about it, but
no problem. Anyway, yeah. So question: who was asking the question? Someone was asking me to elucidate about the whole tragic flaw thing. The Greek word from Aristotle is hamartia. And people translate that like, you know, there's like, you know, he says like that each tragic person has some hamartia. The translation of that as tragic flaw is a mistranslation. Like it doesn't mean tragic flaw in the sense of like this person has just like a personality flaw, which makes them do wrong things. Like hamartia, it means like sin, fault, like when you do something wrong, you have committed a hamartia.
Heme meaning blood, something?
No, not heme.
Heme. Sorry.
Yeah, ham. It's totally different.
I can't hear you. You're spelling it.
Yeah, exactly. anyway, it means like something that you do wrong, right? Like Macbeth's hamartia is not arrogance or ambition. You know, vaulting Hubris. Ambition is normally what is, you know, identified as, and we're getting
kited here. Hang on. Yeah. Let's call this herd a bit.
Okay. Let's see.
Got our little kite tail, don't we?
Okay. There we go. Oh. Excellent.
There we go.
Okay, so anyway, right, so it's not that he has a personality flaw which leads him into inescapable tragedy, it's that he does something bad which leads to tragedy. Like his hamartia is killing the king, right? It's not like that he's an ambitious fellow, you know, and that's what leads him into trouble. Anyway, but it's just, yeah, there is a long centuries-old tradition of like radically oversimplifying.
There are a lot of mops here. We're not going to be able to kite through this. Yes, I've tried. No,
more importantly, this is actually what I'm wanting to look
at. Okay, good.
So,
all right. Yes.
We have come to the destination, not another distraction. So, okay. So where we are on the map, if we look at the map here, we are, okay, so Al-Khair is over here, the Fasak Loran, and so this is the city that we were exploring last time. Up here, we've got Carn Dûm up on the mountaintop. We were looking at it up in the distance from where we were down here. We are now here, so we're further, we're in the southeast corner of this westernmost part of Angmar.
Mm-hmm. We're not under the force field yet, it looks.
No, not. So this area here, which is marked as occupied as like a town on the map, we can already see what kind of area we are looking at. Because, ooh, the full moon rising behind this guy is looking pretty ominous.
I know, it's so picturesque.
Yeah, we have one of these. Oh, man, look at that.
That's Eldritch. Cool. Yeah.
So we have another one of these statues that we've been looking at before. This in a slightly different posture from the other ones, right? I don't remember the other one's mouth being open like this.
The other ones look more like they were trying to get a head start in a speed skating race, and this yes. one's more going... boogity
yes. boogity kind of it's like in full like what warning against or attacking it. You know, when you come around the corner like that, it's right here, right, looking at you.
Yeah,
extremely threateningly.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't see, other than its posture and attitude, I don't see any real differences between this and the other statues we've been mm-hmm. looking at.
Oh, we lost the moon and got the purple lightning now, don't we?
Yes. The moon is just behind that hill, I think, now.
Well, no, where I'm standing, it's all purple lightning now. The moon's gone.
Right. No, I think the moon is just not high enough. I think it's just right behind this. We were getting the purple lightning before, too.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's anyway, atmospheric, maybe.
So when we come over here, we don't need to fight everybody in this whole area, but
yeah,
or you can if you want to, but
just get one in front. I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing that we notice here is we see an old fortification and also a wooden palisade. Now, I don't want to go all the way through this gate, because this gate is interesting in the fact that there's a cliff right on the other side of it.
yeah.
This is the same style of stonework that we've been seeing around, right? Like, this is thinking mm-hmm. back to the different kind of phases of construction that we were looking at in the ruin that we were examining last time.
Yeah, that strange, oily, patina, dark metal.
Yeah, I think this is the... This is the old Angmar, or is it is this new building on the old? Is the black part new and the sort of foundation stone old? Is that what
like
we think?
Like they put a cap on it?
Kind of looks like it almost, doesn't it?
I don't know. The part of this bit on the side with the lines coming down almost looks like it's made to be seamless. Like it's part of the same construction.
Right. Yeah. And looking at it
more
closely,
a little gallery on the side.
The kind of color mottling even the black part on top would seem to suggest that it's old too. Okay, so let's say these are from the same period then. Mm-hmm. And I would say the old period. So this is old Angmar has constructed this. Okay. But now we have the old fortification. And we have the new, this wooden palisade is probably, don't go running through here because there's a cliff.
Yeah.
And you can't get back up. So we can see this wall continuing around almost as if this cliff were itself like inhabited, like there were. It's just weird how the wall goes along the cliff.
Yeah, it's almost like the functional part is that sort of long gallery part.
Yes, as if it's like something built into the walls here, right?
Yeah, some sort of archery blockade kind of thing. Because clearly it didn't need these little wooden dealies here. This is an after.
Yeah, yeah. But
it's almost like they couldn't get into the old design. That's why they had to build these new ones.
Yes. Maybe it's fallen away. Maybe there's...
The door's closed, or it's too broken up inside to go inside.
Yeah, possibly.
Remember the giant fish hook from last time? How we couldn't understand why it was new and shiny.
Yes,
right. I did pop over to Enumenas, the ruins of Enumenas, where they have a lot of the old fish hooks there. They were that same purpley greeny dark metal.
Yeah, same purpley greeny dark metal.
not the new shiny metal that we saw the new fish hook in.
Okay. Okay.
So that was this is a new edition that's new based on the old imposed design.
On the, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the new order of Angmar. Okay. But of course, the fact that we have these wooden palisades butting right up against these old walls shows that we have, look, there's a goblin right there among us. because this is a goblin camp down below.
Yeah.
So we've got goblins and orcs who are, I guess, newly recruited because they don't seem indigenous here. Like, they don't live here. These are new. They're living in tents, right? So,
and they're not familiar with the terrain. They're getting lost and fighting with each other and not sure how to push things down what path and whatever.
Right, exactly. Woohoo. I'm helping. Actually, this reminds me. I should... This will also help. Interesting that we get... So notice these kind of concentric barriers here.
Mm-hmm.
Concentric in style. We had the gateway guarded by the statue. And now we have these palisades with these guarded palisaded gateways here, one after another. Again, these sort of temporary fortifications that are built up. Three sets now here of gates.
Yeah.
Guarding, again, goblin camps. Though it's interesting to me that these palisades, they're rough. I mean, they're wooden, but they're not nearly as rough as most of the goblin built things that we've seen. There are no skulls. There's no blood painting. There's no wolf head totems or anything like that.
Yeah, look how these things are flash with one another right here. This is definitely an Angmar architect.
I think that they're sort of temporary-ish, you know, and comparatively new. But even that, like the cross piece, I'm looking at the cross piece here, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a squared board.
Yeah. With pretty good iron fastenings on it.
Yes, exactly. And we haven't seen, even the spikes there have iron studs on them. And I don't remember seeing anything like that. We're just, you know, all we saw from the goblins were mostly sharpened sticks.
Pointed sticks.
Yeah, pointed sticks. So, Mungli, I agree. And there are no totems. We've always seen, if the totems were like goblin heads themselves, right? There was always... have we ever seen goblin fortifications or things of this kind without...
They were less fortifications and more of a this part mine, that part yours.
Like defensive barriers and boundaries and things like that. Okay, more of these walls built into...
Now, remind me a little bit of some of the orc fortifications that we see in North Downs when we start going to the side of the path after the Trestle Bridge.
Right, right.
But I believe there's some Angmar architects involved there too, or am I mistaken?
I don't remember.
Because the rope bridges in particular look similar to that.
Okay, I have to get rid of this shouting guy, or else like he's just going to jump in and sing.
I hate those guys.
And then he keeps shouting posthumously for like 30 more seconds.
Fire effect.
Here's what I'm confused about, however, and that is this smoke. It's not actually pink, right?
No, I think it's more like the... there's some strange colors in this fire, I do admit.
That's what I don't understand.
I wonder if they're burning some magical items in there or some cursed stuff.
That's what I'm trying to figure out, so...
A lot of boxes of things.
Yeah, there's definitely... That's a shield. There's a shield in there. It's not decorated, though. I wanted to see if this was a shield like the shields that we saw you know, the Tree of Glory have.
That could be any round metal, anything.
Yeah, it really could. And we've got these banners, which are improbably in cloths, which are improbably not yet burning. Maybe they were very soaked.
They look like Arvaduai kind of.
Yeah, so I guess this is just a bunch
Why the boxes? Are they burning their food supply?
Who knows? It's a little strange. I guess it's just like anything loose that was wooden.
Yeah. They have. Without a lot of thought put into it, you wonder if someone got in trouble for some of the things that are burning in there.
Right.
Maybe that's the strange colors, too. Maybe
did
it's some of those strange
fire
goblin poisons in there or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just not
this looks like a meteor crater, doesn't it?
Right. That's what I'm wondering. Like, is this a natural crater that they were just like, we need to build a fire that is proportional to this? Or why do they need a fire of this size? What's going
Sinkhole?
On with this fire? Yeah, I don't know. I don't get this at all. See, this is the kind of fire I would expect in the middle of the... And this is, of course,
looks
the
like
camp.
It,
that's the cliff that we were on the top side of just a little while before.
Yeah, I don't think they made that pit. I think that was a natural thing that they decided to take advantage of.
And they decided not to make a campfire of this kind, but
no,
an enormous bonfire.
Communal just, trash pile slash toilet, probably.
Okay, because they just they're just burning things. It's the town dump, as Crystal Eowyn says.
Yeah, we like explosives. Kaboom!
Yeah, I guess. Oh dear, there's not a roving threat in this camp, is there?
No, that's the fire. Yeah, I thought that was a roving threat too. That's
no, the
actually the fire.
Quest
on the map.
Just popped up.
Oh. Oh, it's because you're. Oh, it's because you're the level that you are.
Yeah.
Well, good. You can steer us clear of it.
Yeah, I just want to make sure. Okay, hang on. Where is it?
If you mouse over any red bits, it'll.
Okay. No, I don't see any red bits, fortunately. Okay.
All right.
But I've got it on my quest thing, so I'll flash yellow if we get close to it, or if it gets close to us.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway. All right. So. I was really interested by the. The towers and walls set in the cliff faces. Oh, okay. Now here's this. So here.
Wow. Yeah.
That banner, because that's a banner. That's cloth up there.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Sorry, I'm just sicking my ego on these things. Okay. Okay, so theory.
Uh-huh.
Theory is that gateway thing, so like the main kind of archway there is old construction, but so the eagle's being a little inconvenient here. Right in my line of sight, blocking what I'm trying to do. Okay.
That is the problem with seabats.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. So, I think that the frame that's holding the banner up top is new.
Yeah, I agree. It looks exactly like the new metal we saw and the new totem we saw.
Exactly. And it looks so, and it's different from the old stone and metal. So this is an old Angmarim construction, but they've erected this new thing just to display this banner, which is displayed
cool
really
looking.
Prominently, and it's huge. Okay,
they definitely got that out of mothballs.
Yeah, well, it's all raggedy. So what is it? I can't see it.
Is it an iron? Well, it's like definitely some sort of crown looking, but it's.
It looks like a crown. What, was there an archway beneath it?
Yeah, it looks like a archway. It does look very much like the sort of arabesque archway we've seen.
I can't remember. I can't remember ever seeing this banner anywhere.
Me neither.
And I feel like we should see
it. It's really interesting. Maybe we're going to see it inside Khardoum.
Maybe. Is this an old Carn Doom banner, in which case it's in pretty poor shape? Now, we know that Orc and Goblin banners are often in very poor shape, right, when they display them. They're often ragged. That's not surprising. But
this looks really, like, good and fallen into disrepair, though. You almost feel like it's supposed to go the whole length.
Exactly.
Well,
yes, you
this
do.
This is all that's left.
I do. Which leads me to suspect that this is not their banner, but that this is a captured banner. Like, it's supposed to be ragged because it's been taken from the enemy in battle, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. Well, or just taken out of some forgotten. It implies that the new flag stand is based off of one that might have possibly been there before, and they've rebuilt it.
Maybe.
And they found what was left of the flag and put it up.
Maybe, yeah. So, I mean, because that does look like a crown, but it, of course, doesn't look like the Iron Crown. And it's, you know, it's gold. We've never seen the Iron Crown of Angmar.
No.
Golden. And it's not proportioned like that either.
And the archway looks familiar, but I can't put in place to that style of arabesque archway.
Yeah, so I don't know.
Not really sure where I've seen that. I know I have, but I've been lots of places in Middle Earth now, so my memory's failing on me on that one.
And I can't remember this arch. So anyway, if anybody knows where we can see either another version of this same raggedy version of this standard up closer, or where we could find a better version of it, like an untorn version of this, I would love to learn that. I would love to know where we could see that, because I don't know where to
find to give us a screen grab or give us the coordinates or something like that, and we'll try to make a trip out.
Yeah.
On a different server.
Exactly. Okay. Well, there's one more part of this area that we can look at. I know it's getting late because I stayed late in class, but I'll just explore around the corner here.
Man, the terrain here, like these sort of granite-looking rocks, really do look like they're eating what was left of the old architecture. You can tell there's been not just a change of governments here. There's been, like, tectonic shifts since.
Yes. Ooh, look, a tree. Something we haven't seen in any of these camps over here. Up here in this other camp over here. So this is an adjacent camp. But now notice that we get here camps that are... I keep hitting the wrong thing.
Oh, yeah, it is like a... Yeah.
This looks just like the... Like in Algaire, like the Tray of Galore. In fact, it's got standard weapons rack here.
Weapons rack, orange segment.
Ooh, bunk beds.
Trisco.
Hey, that's fun. We've got bunk beds in here.
Oh, hey, those are totally like Eglaine run bunk beds there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, hang on a second. I see somebody being shot here. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'll do that.
And this pavilion here, this tent, looks just like we saw out on the North Downs. We also see some of these in Algaire, don't we? Mm-hmm. And they look like the ones that we see in Innuminous as well.
Yep. Oh, and there's your other Eldritch statue with a different pose on there. That one's not bending over. He looks like he's getting his towel off and ready to get in the bath.
He kind of does.
Sorry. Yeah, look at this big old tree here.
I know. People are teasing me about
it. Is it coming out of the geyser?
I don't know. I'm trying to go around the base of it here. It looks like... So this tree is completely dead. It was... This is really strange.
It's devoured by the geyser?
Or,
that's not how they work.
Like, it... Yeah, because its root system starts down here. It's almost like the ground has been... has fallen? But...
This is where... But this looks as the same feature as the poison pools down
yeah,
there.
Yeah, like the like a, one of the fumarole things from down
yeah, it's like
there.
A weird flower vase.
Huh. And maybe we are looks supposed like- to understand that this is some kind of... you know, what's the word that I'm looking for? Building up over time. Accretion? Like some kind of accretion of
mineral deposits?
Yeah. Like a tree engulfing stalagmite, but where, from, and how, I have no idea.
Maybe it's a petrified tree.
Yeah, well, the tree is dead. It's encased in stone.
Yeah. I don't even want to... I don't know. That's like I'm racking my brain for anything, you know. I don't know of symbiotic geological and botanical
right.
hybrids at all.
Right.
So I think we're just supposed to use our imagination and assume this is just some really cursed tree.
But that's the interesting thing. The thing that's interesting to me is that it's here. Like,
yeah.
This was a great tree. Like, this was an enormous tree, and it's been kept. Like, here it is, dead and preserved, even partially fossilized, right? Based on its,
mm-hmm.
based on, you know, on the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been preserved. Like, the
yeah.
goblins from the next camp over haven't cut it down and used it to feed their disproportionately large fire. Right? Like, no one's burned it or used it for construction. Why not?
They're afraid of it.
Are they afraid of it?
Maybe.
Does it mean something?
Is it turning to stone and they can't cut it down? Is it too big?
Yeah.
Was it considered a waste of effort?
I don't know. It's just like, I can't see an enormous tree like this. I can't see an enormous tree like this in the middle of a, you know, this big courtyard and not think of Gondor, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's where my brain went to.
Yeah. I mean, it's just... Yeah, to me, that's even more important than the, like, the mechanics of the... I mean, I wasn't even looking at the weird sort of fossilized mud or calcification or whatever else, but yeah, it must have some meaning to them, Amethorn. It's hard to imagine that this was like, that it's like Gondor, right? That this was once a living tree which is being
yeah.
preserved in reverence, right? That just doesn't fit. It's like not in the Angmarim idiom, you know? What then? Would it be more in their idiom would be, this was once a great tree that, you know, was, this was once a great tree that was like, you know, good and famous and excellent and has been conquered and destroyed and kept as a trophy, you know, after
uh-huh.
it was dead. That's kind of more, would seem to be more in the Angmarim idiom, but what then could it be? Which raises the question, the broader question, what was this place anyhow? Angmar.
Yeah.
I mean, you know? Like, before Carn Dûm was built.
You think the some point the people were, this was like a prosperous kind of, you know, if it's the illusion of this is going to be the peaceful country
well,
and we're going to protect everybody. And
you wonder, right? I mean, there were a lot of dead trees and stuff out there in the Fossac Lorat. I mean, it looked like it would have once been a lush and green, you know, hill country over there. So clearly the land was not always like this. You know, what we're seeing here is a desolation that has been created by, you know, the presence of evil for a long period of time. And this tree would seem to be a kind of symbol of that.
Maybe it's clinging on to life, like just by like a bare thread or something like that. Maybe no matter what has happened, it's not going down.
Maybe. Maybe it's still alive. In which case, you think they would totally kill it. I don't know.
But, ant wife. No, I'm not doing that.
Could it be an ant wife? Yeah. No. Definitely not an ant wife.
Sorry, I was playing the silly card there on that one. Yeah.
Well, no, that was suggesting
knowing what I know about the developers
in the Twitch chat too.
Yeah.
Noxie Key was saying, is it a captive? I mean, it almost looks like it's imprisoned, right? I mean, it's like a tree in leg irons here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like maybe the dark sorcerers called up a blight on it or something.
Right.
I don't know.
And then all around here, because it looked past the tents, right? Forget about the tents, mm-hmm. which are obviously new and temporary structures.
Mm-hmm.
Look at what this would have been when this tree was green.
A courtyard.
A courtyard. And all around, we've got these cliffs on three sides. Okay, two sides. We've got a wall on the third side, and these walls set into the cliffs all around. This would have been a big courtyard. So apparently this whole... So these walls are not defensive structures. These walls are... What? The outer faces, at least, of so like the this was a city that was set into the walls here,
like a like residences
into
or...
the cliffs, right? So
yeah,
that, yeah. So that people lived inside like the cliffs and
like a circular lead kind of deal,
right. And this was a big old.
It's a reminder. It's a reminder that the Witch King was once a human who needed fresh air,
maybe?
Who needed, you know, renewable resources, who needed beautiful things to look at, you know?
The walls, you know, the buildings, the habitations here built into the cliffs all around this courtyard that housed this great huge tree, which towers even over the walls, even equal to the lower portions of this tower set up in the cliffside. Higher up down there to the south. This huge tree obviously would have been there. You know, when all...
Maybe not this big.
Yeah, maybe it wasn't this big. But maybe it was. I mean, maybe it's been dead for, you know, hundreds of years. I don't know.
Mm.
But, yeah. Deathman42 is asking, is it a sapling of the white tree now corrupted? This seems like a deliberate echo.
It does. It does feel like just some sort of lost seed that found its way into a kingdom of man it was not entitled to be in.
Yeah.
Or was not entitled to have it, I should say.
Are we then to understand that in a sense, the kingdom of Angmar, as it was originally constituted, because all of this is old construction. We're not seeing any new mm-hmm. construction other than the mm-hmm. tents and palisades, obviously. But I mean, none of that,
yes.
no newer stonework or anything. So all of the construction that we're able to see here is from the old Angmar before the first downfall of Angmar. So hundreds of years before, under the Witch King himself. So that the Witch King was establishing this, that it's, are we to understand that it's actually kind of a memory of Gondor or a parody of Gondor or
it's either similar to Gondor, like, you know, they came from the same place, had the same roots, same architectural styles and technological advances, or mm-hmm. it does remind me a bit of, you know, the Tolkien's comment that evil can never create, it can only ape.
Right.
You know? even if this was a kingdom. Though you have to imagine it, though, before this horrible, you know, greasy patina set in, before the right. stone became all moldy and thing, this would have been a shining white courtyard with silver right. well, tops on everything.
Right. Though the top part might have been black, however. I mean, it might have been black and white.
Well, not okay, not silver, but definitely shining, you know, gunmetally.
Right, gunmetally, I can see. Yeah, exactly. But no, Forthalus, I'm not imagining the Witch King living here prior to his corruption. It would have been after his corruption.
Yes.
It would have been built by the Witch King as the Witch King when he's setting. So it would have to be a parody. It'd have to be a mockery, or at least a. I mean, maybe even some kind of, I don't know what, longing imitation of or something.
Mm-hmm. Or a reward for his loyal subjects. Remember, they would want to, you know, he'd want to reward right. the people who were faithful to them with nice apartments and beautiful courtyards and sparkling fountains.
Yes. And Emmathorn, was this part of the Northern Kingdom? I don't think we've seen any evidence of that.
There's nothing Rudauran about it, for sure.
No, there's no. We haven't seen anything here, any stonework or anything, any ruins. We haven't seen a single Numenorean star anywhere since we came to Angmar. As you say, nothing even Rudauran. That was all south of here. Interesting. Well, this is cool. I didn't even notice this tree before. I literally just noticed it as we were coming in from the outside there.
Every time I've been in this area, I've been running with a crowd of 50 Angmar behind me.
Yeah. It's true. I have never had the leisure before of just standing here in the courtyard and imagining what this must have looked like 500 years before. Bricktails, we don't know anything about where the Witch King came from originally. We know that three of the Nazgul were Numenoreans, originally, you know, came from Numenorean blood. But that's all we know. We're told very little about the backstory of the Nazgul, and in particular of the Witch King.
We could always make a guess that the Witch King was a black Numenorean, but...
Yeah, we could guess, but we're not even told that much for sure.
That is a question. Is this aping maybe not Gondor, but Numenor?
But Numenor itself, yes. Yes, exactly. I was just thinking the same thing.
They like the tall towers.
Right.
That'd be great to survive a flood in.
Yeah, exactly. Ah, so we've got a little little pseudo Mental Tarma over here, right? The thing up in the south, right? Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah, so it wouldn't be an imitation of Gondor, as you say. It would bear this just as the tree and the courtyard in Minas Tirith is a memory of Gondor, of Numenor. So this would be a memory of Numenor. If the Witch King were Numenorean.
And of course, Tinadir is also sort of a version and, you know, assumed to be a copy of Numenor. So we're seeing everyone's interpretations of a white shining city.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
It is kind of cool. So what was this called? Balrova is what this place is called? Okay. And I wonder... This seems like it was probably beachfront. Also, thinking of Tinudir, right?
Beachfront property.
This was beachfront property. If we go back outside our,
also explains that random sinkhole.
Right, because see, right here, like immediately outside these walls, is down into the lower terrain, which is wet. And one could easily imagine may once have been wetter than it currently is.
I also like how they sort of mimic the salt deposits you'd see.
Yeah.
On a dried up seabed.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But, okay. Anyway, we'll go down to the dried up seabed next time. So.
Yeah, I think so.
And I should, so I should let everybody go because it's super late.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so thank you all for joining me. Let's not forget now, I think we have come to the end. So by next week's field trip, we're going to have to cross the, or I believe we'll be crossing the boundaries.
The Watchers.
Yeah, the Watchers.
Yeah.
So you do have to pick up the Epic Quest line and do a couple of the Epic Quests in order to get
book
past.
Book six.
Book six.
Book six starts in Esteldin.
Starts in Esteldin. I think you might be able to pick up the quest from what's his name, Coronir up in
you have to start it in Esteldin. I spent so many times running around O'Hare looking for Coronir.
Okay, all right, so pick it up in Esteldin. And which server are we on next week?
Let me see, I did have that open and I closed it. Story of my life. Landreval.
Landreval. Okay. All right. We're on Landreval next week. Whew. That'll be a little bit easier. Okay.
Yeah, just a bit.
So Landreval next time, and we'll be going past the Watchers. Probably at least we're coming right up to the very brink of it here, so we should be prepared for that.
Definitely.
All right. So thanks everybody for joining us, and we will see you guys next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for joining me on this epic exploration of The Lord of the Rings and of Standing Stone's video adaptation of Tolkien's story. If you are having even half the fun I'm having on this journey, I hope you will consider supporting the project by donating at signumuniversity.org/fund.